Good morning. How are you all? You well? How was the party, more importantly? I got some claps. So this is how ATV and UEV align with an evergreen Windows 10. This session is all about how you can get yourself to this evergreen state. We're going to go through some design elements of ATV, so how we're inboxing the ATV and UEV client into Windows 10. So we're going to talk through some of those concepts and talk through how you can actually, some of the design issues that you can hit when you deploy your initial Windows 10 anniversary image. So my name's David Falkus. As you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not from the US. I've flown all the way over here from London to present to you guys about ATV and UEV. So I'm a senior Premier Field Engineer. So my role entails traveling around Europe, Asia, and the US, talking to our customers about ATV and helping them on their journey towards this evergreen experience. I'm actually based in London now, so I used to travel around Europe constantly. So I was a flying man like Steve is, but no longer a flying man. I literally commute back and forth to London. And I work in the finance sector. So anyone in finance knows it's always quite complex, large amounts of users. So I've got lots of experience in the big wide world of finance. And this is my good colleague, Mr. Thomas.
Hello, how are you? My name is Steve Thomas. I've been with Microsoft as of this past May 10 years. Very happy. I originally was an escalation engineer in support. Some of you may have spoken to me on the phone in the past if you opened up a case with Microsoft support. In 2012, I moved over to Enterprise Services, also known as Microsoft Consulting Services. And I do a lot of flying around to different customers, doing a variety of engagements on applications, application management, application virtualization, application compatibility, RDS, VDI, et cetera. I am based out of a town called North Richland Hills, which is right outside of Fort Worth, Texas. A lot of people say Dallas. We over in Tarrant County kind of have a chip on our shoulder about that. We're proud to be from Fort Worth. And yes, I do have an accent that may come in and out sometime. And it's kind of a hybrid North Carolina-Texas accent because I'm originally from North Carolina.
Steve actually told me off for putting on one of the slides Dallas, and he was like, you cannot put Dallas.
No,
I'm not from Dallas.
Definitely not.
I told off.
And thank you for coming. I know it's Friday, it's one of the last sessions. Everyone's still recovering from the party last night, and very happy for you to be here. So, real quickly, a little bit of a shameless plug. We're both available on Twitter. We both blog extensively about application technologies, especially in the ATV world. I am extremely privileged to finally have David Falkus at a public conference speaking with me. David Falkus, I'm going to blow a little smoke here, is one of our best-kept secrets at Microsoft, and he's usually reserved for our best and toughest customers. And so you haven't seen him a lot in the past because he's been heads down digging out a lot of things involving ATV and ATV Premier Field Engineering, as well as UEV as well. But I highly encourage you to visit his blog. We got him starting to blog this year, and it's been wonderful. It's blogs.technet.microsoft.com/virtual-shell. And of course, you can always check out my blog, which, just to let everyone know, I am now blogging again. I took a bit of a six-month hiatus, but I am back. blogs.technet.microsoft.com/gladiatormsft. So, you hear us talk about an evergreen Windows. What do we mean by the concept of an evergreen Windows? Well, as you've been going to sessions here at Ignite, and as you have been reading about the past year in Windows 10, Windows 10 has evolved into an operating system that gets away from the old OS migration project and updating model, where we update an OS as a huge deployment and application migration project every, 3 years, 5 years, in some case 7 or 8 years. An evergreen Windows coincides with our new Windows as a service model, where we deal with not a lot of rip and replaces, but a lot of in-place upgrades. These are iterative updates. You've seen a lot of that if you've adopted Office 365. So the question is, how do we adapt our applications and our important elements of applications, primarily user state, to coincide with this Windows as a service, this Windows model of the future? And the idea is customers want the capability of decoupling applications and not leaving an installation full footprint. They want lift and shift applications. In addition, they want to be able to make the user state granular and portable, be it on a per application basis, if it's that granular, or on a more global basis, but in a method that can easily move with the iterations of, first of all, going from Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 to Windows 10, and then the subsequent post-Windows 10 migration lifecycle, which is this Windows as a service model. So decoupling the user state, along with decoupling the applications, allows for this integration, and at the same time, allows for applications to become more portable, not just in terms of iterations of Windows, but allowing an application to have a flexible, modernized package format, and the user state to be decoupled in a flexible, modernized package format, so the application's user state can roll with the user, not just on a mobile laptop or a physical desktop, but also in VDI models and with session host-based applications as well. But the key is frequent, incremental, minor updates. And what we are telling you is we're getting away from the concept of Windows, a specific version. We're moving into, instead of this huge, massive undertaking of a project every 5 to 7 years where we have to do a massive rationalization and discovery of our application inventory and have this huge deployment planning component, that we move to more of a risk-based iterative migration project management style. And again, it's Windows nothing. Windows will be Windows. Edge will be Edge. How many of you can tell me what version of Google Chrome you're using? Okay, never mind. Smart Alex. I forget who my audience is, okay? But you get the idea. You get the idea. So you heard me talk about a term called package modernization. Now to speak a little bit more on package modernization, I'm going to turn this now to Mr. Falkus.
Thanks, Steve. So how many people are still using MSI technology? Deploying MSIs. How many people are on using AppX, as in Windows 10 store apps? Couple? Abby 5? That was meant to be the whole room. So packages have modernized. So if you look at MSI technology is 10 years old, 15 years old technology. We need to get into the future. You look at what we're doing with O365, we're putting things in the cloud, we're taking things off-prem, on-prem to off-prem. And it's the same in the packaging world. We need to get away from this MSI technology world. So when you look at, we classify it as a classic Windows app. So an MSI consists of a Win32 processes, so that's DLLs and your exes. It consists of your .NET components. It consists of COM, which interacts with your base operating system, and you have your drivers as well. And generally, MSIs are delivered via a XAML app or a Windows format. And that is how we construct our MSI. That's generally how our MSIs are constructed. But enterprises have challenges. And what are those challenges? Complex installers. I'll talk about our installers. So Office 2010, you had the OCT tool where you could customize it. It was really complex. You had lots and lots of options. Look what we've done with Office 2013, is that we've suddenly made Office 2013 click to run where we package it for you and we give it to you. You don't have to do any of these complexities anymore. The second challenge is actually app OS compatibility. So when you have XP, you're sequencing, you're creating your MSIs and delivering to the platform, but you have the OS value tag set in the MSI saying, only install on this OS. So when you come to Windows 7, Windows 8, and Windows 10, they don't install. So you have those complexities. They're fragile. How many times have you installed an app and it's failed to install, but it works in another machine? I'm sure you've all seen it before. When you're in thousands and thousands of desktops, it does happen. And we're trying to move away to this modern world. And they are expensive to maintain. You have to get your BAU team, your packaging team, to repackage it and take those MSIs, create transform files, and push them out via config manager, etc. So So we want to move into a new world, and the new world is following the OPC standard. So who's heard of the OPC standard? One person in the room who's one of my friends. Does anybody know what it stands for? It stands for the Open Packaging Convention Standard. And basically, it was created by the office team. It's a standard, but the office team used this standard. And have you ever renamed a docx to a zip file? You can actually open up a docx file and see what's inside and fix the problems with your template and put it back to a docx and then save it and push it out. This is following this standard that we're following. Then in Windows 8 came APEX. APEX, so they're your Windows Store application. So when you click your start menu, you had the store apps. They are APEX applications. What we did as a product, the AppV product, is we took this APEX standard and we changed it. We extended it to support COM. We extended it to support AppPass. We extended it to support more of our subsystems that we want to use today.
Most importantly, isolation.
And most importantly, isolation. So we have AppV. And they are our three standards. APEX is for modern apps. So look at Edge. Edge is a modern app. AppV is for sequencing traditionally installed apps. But they are all based on OPC. OPC looks like this. It is an archive zip file. If you rename a .appv file to .zip or a .appx file to .zip, you will see all these components. Content types, it's an XML file, which is your schema of your package, which points to all your XML files. Fantastic. Your XML files consist of your appx manifest file, consist of your file system metadata files, and consists of all these components. And then finally, it's pretty hard to deploy an AppV app without any DLLs or exes, because you need something to run. We actually put in the zip file your file and resource assets. So if you look at the top right of the screen, you will actually see the .docx renamed to a zip file. You can see content types to XML file. So when you get back to your office, try this. Rename a .docx and see what it looks like. AppX is the same. You'll see the right at the bottom, content types, appx manifest file. You will see those components. And then you can guess what's coming next. AppV's coming next. AppV, where you have the block map, you have the content types, you have your root directory, and your dat file. So this is where we're moving towards. We're trying to move away from the MSI technology to appx and to AppV technology. So we're actually going to talk about Project Centennial as well. But we need to follow an approach. And the approach with Windows 10 anniversary, we have a two-fold approach. Hopefully, most people in this room are IT pros. So an IT pro will generally look at AppV as their technology of choice, where you take a package, you put it through our sequencer, which is a GUI tool which allows you to capture your package. You create your .appv package, and then you deliver it via a software distribution tool. Whether it be Config Manager, whether it be our AppV full infrastructure, whether it be third party, which I'm sure some of you may be using. We're not all using Config Manager for our delivery. But our second approach is for developers and ISVs. And that is Project Centennial, the Universal Windows Platform, allows you to actually convert an MSI into APEX format. And we're going to show you this as well. You have to put it through a converter. The converter is PowerShell driven, so it's a lovely PowerShell script which you'll see. It creates your .appx file, and then you can deliver it via the Windows Store, or you can actually sideload it into Windows directly, which I'm going to do on my machine. So I'm going to show you, hopefully, the quickest sequence ever of an AppV package. So what we're going to do is, if you load the sequencer, you can do create new package. So you get to choose create package. You then get to choose what kind of app you want to install, so your standard app, your add-on or plugin or middleware. And then you specify your installer. So this is quite funny. I'm actually going to use Orca. I'm trying to get modernized, and I'm going to use Orca. You give it a package name, so Microsoft Orca in my instance.
The irony is not lost on them.
And literally, all I'm going to do, I'm monitoring at this point, so anything that happens now, I'm going to capture. So I'm going to do basic standard installation. I'm going to copy my files. I'm now going to launch it. I'm launching it just to see if it runs on my sequencer right? Orca launches. So now you can at the Orca, and then you can deliver it out and you do all your work. And finish installing, and then we're going to collect all those changes. So any file registry edits that we had will be captured on our sequencer and put into our .atv package. There's no issues, obviously. We're going to click next, and literally I'm going to stop now because there's no point in me carrying on, and literally save my package. So you'll see on the left-hand side, I'm actually going to create a folder on the desktop with my .atv package of Orca sequence. So once that's finished and it's captured all those settings, I can open up that folder, and you actually see an .atv package created in less than a minute. That is how easy sequencing is. Trust me. It does get more difficult, don't worry, but we're showing you the basic application. So you can do it really quickly. When we move on to Centennial, though, Centennial is slightly different. So Centennial is all about the Windows Store. It's about creating a well-defined app model, about using the Universal Windows platform to deliver your applications to the machine. You can enhance it with the UWP APIs, so that's like live tiles. So quite a lot of people like the live tiles, so when you're looking at your start menu, things change. People quite like that. And basically, we can reach every device. But there is a two-fold approach to Centennial as well. Your approaches are the desktop app converter, which is pure PowerShell. This is now available in the Windows Store. So you can actually go to the Windows Store and download the desktop app converter. So they've converted their own app and put it in the store as an Apex package so that they can create packages, which is really cool. I really liked it. I was speaking to the PM yesterday. I thought it was a really great idea that we did that. And the second approach is using Visual Studio. So we have a packaging project, a Universal Windows Platform packaging project, which you can download. You can load it into Visual Studio, and you can create your packages from there. I'm going to say a few things now. People are thinking that you convert all your apps and you just keep converting your MSIs. You don't do that. You convert once, and then you start putting things into Visual Studio. So it is very focused at developer. This is it in action. So I've done a script for this to make my life a bit easier. So we have the desktop app converter, the PS1 file. We specify our installer. So again, we're going to do Orca. Awesome. One of the challenges, you have to have a quiet installation. So you have to do a quiet install, so you can't have an interactive install for the desktop app converter. You give it an output directory, you give it a package name, and one of the biggest things about the store, you have to have them signed with a certificate. But the benefits of certificates means it's a valid product from a valid vendor. It's not some random person putting something on the web and you downloading it. I'm going to use a sign tool from the Windows kit, so I'm going to sign it with certificate, so I'm going to sideload on my machine. So I'm not going to cheat, I'm actually going to sideload it directly. And then finally at the bottom, I'm going to use an add apex package command to add it in. So anyone who knows appv, add appv client package, add apex package is the same for a Centennial. So this is the script, and this is why this is focused at developers, and you'll see why. When it runs, and it's going to go in 1 second, it's close. It's really, really close. And off we go. That is me creating an Apex package of Orca. And this is why we're very focused at developers from this side. If you know appv, you'll see the VFS entry. So we're using very similar ways of packaging your applications. And then finally, at the very end, we're going to make that Apex package and make it available in my desktop. So if I click start now and search for Orca, there is Orca, delivered via Apex and Project Centennial. The interesting thing is, you go into the directory, you'll see the .apex package and all the file assets. So again, I could rename that and have a look at it and see what's been captured. And also, the really cool thing about Centennial is, because it's very developer-focused, we actually write some really great logging. So by default, the desktop app converter creates it in the root of your directory. And basically everything you saw in my PowerShell window, you will see in this log file. So you can open it with Trace32 or CMTrace, and you'll see errors, etc., in this log. But be very aware, you've got appv is targeted at IT pros, and you've got Centennial, which is targeted at your developers. If you follow the Centennial blog, the Universal Windows Platform blog, Evernote have just converted their app, their MSI, to a Windows Store application and delivered it via the store. So they get the full MSI experience from a Windows Store application, which is really, really cool what they've done to do that. So that's what we, when we talk about package modernization, that's what we're talking about. How we can go from the past to the future. The past is MSI technology, the future is AppV, AppX, and going forward maybe something else. If you've got Office 365 and you're using the Click to Run package, behind the scenes, that's basically AppV's doing the work behind the scenes for Click to Run. So you can see where we're moving. We're trying to modernize our packages and move forward to a new world, to the future. So that's modernization. I'm going to pass it back on to Steve, and Steve's going to talk to you about how we evolved the user state. So what happened with user states from 10 plus years ago to actually today? Tell us, Steve.
So the key thing that David told you is, with this concept of package modernization, we don't actually do an installation. Packages kind of exist in an installed state. And we get this single click, double click type mentality for installation. It's that lift and shift model. So going forward in a new Windows world, we have to couple, even though we're decoupling our apps and user state from the operating system, we have to always have the planning and the design and the modernization of the application and its corresponding user state as a combined management focus within your organization. And this is a great time to talk about getting our user state in a similar fashion, whether you're using UEV, which is what the focus of this is in terms of this particular session in Microsoft solution, or if you're using another similar Microsoft solution like ESR, the Enterprise State Roaming, or if you're using a partner, a third party UEM like AppSense or Amidio or RES, all of them are following this new model of decoupling user state, or in some cases they like to use the term virtualization. I prefer more of decoupling and state separation.
So who's using UEV today? Are you on the latest version 2.1 SP1, or are you inboxing into Windows 10? So 2.1 SP1, we're quite close.
So let's get this out of the way. Let's talk about roaming user profiles. How many of you still use roaming user profiles? How many of you are still using roaming user profiles by choice? For the audience at home, no one raised their hand. So roaming user profiles consist of a combination of user data and settings with a whole bunch of extra stuff. So when we're trying to move away from roaming user profiles, we first need to kind of take apart a roaming user profile, and let's look at what is important for the end user experience, primarily the end user shell experience, or the end user Windows experience, and the end user application experience. So documents, obviously. Documents are very important. Favorites. By favorites, we mean our browser favorites. But not just that, links, anything that is a quick shortcut to an asset. Media. Media is often there, depending on the organization and what the organization does and policy. Downloads. Downloads is sometimes a residual thing. And then, of course, we have the key element of a user profile, the actual registry hive, the ntuser.dat file. And then, of course, if an application has been properly developed for Windows and complies with the Windows logo, we have all the application settings inside of app data. Now, probably the most key elements of a profile in terms of availability and roaming are the settings for the user, primarily the shell settings in ntuser.dat and app data. What's interesting is these can easily be managed today and going forward, not necessarily by one complete solution, but by a collection of solutions to get us away from roaming user profiles. Because let's talk about the challenges with roaming user profiles. Roaming user profiles are on a network share. They get bloaty. And of course, the entire profile has to be downloaded upon logging on, and of course, uploaded when logging off. So we have the issue of slow logons. They're fragile. It's very common to have the potential for especially if there's not a proper log off, or if there is an issue with a hanging application, or a laptop or device crashes, the fragility of roaming user profiles can arise, and it puts many times it can put the user state at risk. And of course, they're expensive. There are so many things in the roaming user profile that are not critical to the end user experience or the end user application experience. So we have the capability of taking certain parts of the profile, primarily our shell folders, and redirecting them with folder redirection. We can actually decouple and use the documents, favorites, media downloads, our shell folders, and we can actually redirect them to a location that is actually separated from the profile. This is what many of our customers are doing now. However, we still have the concept of a roaming user profile, primarily because we still have to pull down the registry hive. And likewise, applications still have to have access to their data, and redirecting app data is a very dangerous thing and can lead to all kinds of potential issues. So with folder redirection by itself, it speeds up the logon significantly. It gives us some state separation and some resilience for user elements that are especially critical, especially the user documents, and of course the things that are decoupled from the registry, like favorites and shortcuts. But we need something to address the final piece of roaming user profiles that we have to deal with, and that is the shell settings, the preferences, and the individual application settings that would normally go either in the registry hive or in app data. So what we do with UEV is we look at the most critical components of the user experience and we create templates. And at the same time, we allow application owners to create settings templates for the individual applications. And we not only decouple and granularize our user state, but we granularize the actual syncing to where it's not always a global sync. We have a variety of sync triggers to where when we actually synchronize using those sync triggers, we use what is necessary for the actual experience. For example, logons. We only need to synchronize our Windows settings and our desktop settings and ease of access settings at logon. We only need to worry about synchronizing application settings when an application launches or when application shuts down. But what UEV does is it allows you to place on a file share or on a cloud storage location, locally cached cloud storage location, or through the use of the offline file sync provider, it allows you to store all of these individual setting storage packages in that same PKGX style format that also adheres to the OPC standard as well. And this will give you the fastest logon, it's very flexible, and it gives you a consistent experience. And it gives you a little bit of flexibility when you're moving across different platforms, RDS, Windows 10. If you are in the process of moving from Windows 7 to Windows 8.1, it can help create a more seamless move to Windows 10. But UEV is not the only solution. We also have ESR. Now, ESR is our cloud solution, whereas UEV is more of our on-premises solution. ESR, whereas UEV works with our on-premises domain model, ESR works with our Azure AD cloud model. And what this does is it allows you to have specific settings roam using a cloud backend. So things like themes, IE and edge settings, control panel, and specific other Windows settings, and your universal Windows app settings can also roam with ESR. Because when UEV, while we constantly listen to your feedback, and we have been constantly adding things into the product, UEV does not roam 100% of everything. And what we do is we look to our customers to tell us what are the important elements to roam. And that's what we are deciding on the back end, is how do we best serve our customers for both on-prem and cloud. Plus, we also realize that a lot of our customers are moving from on-premises to the cloud in a gradual way as well, and they need options, and we want to give them options. And so we have a series of three elements to help us get away from roaming user profiles. We have all of these roaming user profile elements that users and IT pros want to roam, and we want to give you a set of options that allow you to actually roam either through UEV, either through ESR, and in some cases, for file assets and shell folders, we still recommend folder redirection. And that could be folder redirection to a network share. That could be folder redirection to your local OneDrive or OneDrive for Business cache, so you can actually leverage the cloud on the back end to synchronize that. The same with work folders as well, or even Dropbox. But while things like individual application settings, like let's say Adobe, Adobe Acrobat, Adobe Document Cloud, all of those are great and ideal for UEV templates, things like your contacts folder, documents folder, favorites, pictures, regardless, any of these shell folders, we still advise folder redirection. Now, one little caveat. While special folders can also be roamed via work folders, OneDrive, or OneDrive for Business, it is important to understand that we honor the configuration and the setup of the what we call the external or non-sync provider. Because when you actually use as your sync provider OneDrive, OneDrive for Business, or work folders, we are completely passing it off to the local cache folder for those particular cloud storage services, and it is up to them to ensure that the actual PKG files, or in the case of redirected folders, are actually getting properly synchronized on the back end. So with that, you've heard about application decoupling, an overview. You've heard about user state decoupling. Let's see how it all ties in together with the Windows 10 anniversary build. And for that, I'll pass it back over to Mr. Falkus.
So how many people have actually deployed or tested the Windows 10 anniversary build? So most of the room, really cool. Traditionally, AppV and UEV, or that it still does, it sits in the MDOP package. And you had to download MDOP, you had to download all the components, and then install them manually. You then had to download our hotfixes from our KB site and patch them that way as well. What we've done in Windows 10 for AppV and UEV is we've actually inboxed them into the operating system. And the reason why Steve's talking about the Windows as a service model, it makes it easier for us to service the package, service AppV and UEV by having it inboxed into Windows itself. For those people in the Citrix world who've got Server, we're also going to inbox it into Server 2016. And the key point here is one of the biggest complaints we had, or well, not complaints, but biggest bit of feedback we had when we first announced this, we only stated data center. We actually then found out we're going to support standard edition as well. But note on the Windows 10 stuff, it's enterprise and education edition only. So now they're both inbuilt into the OS. So this is a freshly built machine. Can you spot anything on the two pictures of the client which is potentially an issue? They're both disabled by default. On an upgrade, it's a different story, but it's a brand new build. They are disabled by default. Guess how you enable them? It's either by group policy, or you run enable-appv. Really cool. We had some feedback in the early betas. What we used to do is we literally just used to enable AppV, and that was it. We didn't tell you anything. We didn't tell you if it was successful. We didn't tell you if it was wrong. And then we did get AppV status as part of the MVP program and customer feedback about how that works.
For those of you from Texas, beta is beta. Just a translation there.
My English. And router is router, I think it is. I can't say it.
I'm also translating.
And we did the same thing for UEV as well. So UEV is enabled, dash UEV enables it. And then again, from feedback, we put in the get UEV status so that you actually knew what was happening. You can set this via group policy as well. So the new ADMX for AV and UEV, you can enable it out of box there. But it was, we wanted to give you something graphical so that you knew that what status your AV client was at. So this is how it looks on Windows 10. This is a Windows 10 anniversary build. And what I'm going to do is something quite interesting, actually. I'm going to go and try and install the old versions. So this is the 5.1 client. This is Windows 10 anniversary, the 5.1 client, and the UEV 2.1 SP1 client as well. Has anybody tried this? Anybody know what happens? Look at the bottom right-hand side when I install this. So if I go ahead and run the Aidence setup, bottom right-hand corner, the app cannot run on this PC. We actually block you installing the XEs and the MSIs for the UEV agent and the AV client as well. We will actually block you. Works so that it happens with the XE and with the MSI. So if you try this, you can't actually get it installed on the machine. So I'm going to go to PowerShell. You have to run this as admin. You cannot run this as a user. Enable dash AV as a user. You have to be an administrator. So leverage UAC. We're going to run get AV status. So this is just showing you a brand new build of Windows 10. So you can see that it's disabled, so it's not enabled. And the same with get UEV status. We're in the same command. This will be disabled as well. You may have guessed from the slide before what we're going to do here. We're actually going to go ahead and enable them. Just showing the very simple commands. So enable dash AV, which will actually enable the client. It does take a few seconds to enable it, but it does go ahead and enable it. We're going to run the get AV status as well, just to make sure that once I've run enable dash AV, that it does actually say that I'm actually enabled. And we'll do the same thing with UEV as well. But we have lots of questions. What does inboxing actually mean? And that's one of the biggest questions we have. What does inboxing mean? So this is just the final piece. So this is just doing the get UEV status. Please note that when you enable UEV, you need to reboot the machine. We are very verbose. We do tell you you need a reboot. And then get UEV status is actually going to tell you it requires a reboot and it's been enabled. So what does inboxing mean? Instead of being installed to C program files, Microsoft Application Virtualization Client, AV Client, we now put them directly in Windows System 32 directory. So now you see the AV Client .exe. If you do properties of this, this is the build of Windows. 14393. And it's the same thing for UEV. Inboxing means we're putting them in the Windows System 32 directory so we can service it easier and quicker. That's the idea behind why we've done this. So that's what we mean by inboxing. What's happening with out-of-box components? So does anybody use the AV full infrastructure? There's a few. Hope you like it. I love it. If you want to use a 5.1 infrastructure, you have to still get the MDOP ISO from your download site to get those installers. The sequencer and the UEV generator has changed, though. Now you need to download it from the ADK. So you need the Windows 10 ADK to download the new sequencer and the generator as well. So we've moved it outside of the ISO. You have to use the ADK to get the information. So following on from what we mean by what's happening in the anniversary build, and you can see that it's to make it easy to service. It's to make it easy so you don't have to run through all this patching, manual testing of hotfixes. How do we get to this evergreen experience? And Steve talked at the beginning, evergreen is lift and shift your apps, decouple your user state. How do we get there? And a lot of people, when they look at AV and UEV in Windows 10, we always concentrate on the endpoint. The endpoint in this instance is my beautiful tablet with my operating system deployed to it. So it's easy to deploy an operating system. It's not difficult. The next thing to be evergreen is to make sure your apps get down to the box. And obviously, in my instance, I'm going to use AV. But how do you make your users happy? I always say, it's a UK term more than anything, the users are the kings and queens of your environment. They are the bosses. You may have CEOs, CIOs, but the users who use your system, they own you. If they have a great experience, you get no IT calls. Have you ever noticed that? But you never get thanked for no IT calls, which I've never understood. I think you should all get thanked for the great work you do. And that's the third component. The third component is your UEV, your state. Your user state is key to the puzzle, making sure your users get that same experience. Whatever device they go onto makes your users happy, which means less support calls, which means more work time for you to look at new features and functionalities of Windows and Server and Azure and O365. But when you look at the endpoint, when you break down at V, and we delivered this deck a few times internally, is that internally people see at V and UEV as this very small piece of a puzzle. It's a niche technology. But when you expand on what at V talks to, it gets quite complex and quite wide. You need to know a lot about Windows to service and look after these two products. The first one is application delivery and hosting. Full infrastructure for delivery, configuration manager, whether you standalone mode or you host it in Azure IaaS. We then open up streaming, storage. Remember, at V is a streaming technology. You can stream from SMB or you can stream from HTTP. Are you using SMB 1, 2, or 3? Are you using modern backends so you can use the better protocols for streaming? If you're having a slow streaming experience and you're on SMB 1 or 2, and then you try out an SMB 3 with 10 gig networking, you'll notice your streaming is virtually instant. Same with HTTP and HTTPS. How to be evergreen. Your user state. Your user state, as Steve has explained, is quite complex. You can have roaming profiles, folder redirection, UEV, ESR. It's about getting that great strategy going forward to manage that state so you can make it easier. We then talk about delivery. Are you delivering to RDS? Are you delivering to Windows 10? Are you delivering to stateless VDI? Or are you delivering to RDS hosted in our cloud? There are so many questions to answer to make your lives really have a great experience helping your users. How do you build your OS? Are you using MDT? Are you using WDS? Any Citrix people here? Anyone use PBS or MCS, Machine Creation Services? You need to think about how you build your operating system to cope with these two small components of at V and UEV. It's really, really important in a PBS scenario. And then finally, packaging. So it's fantastic you can create a build, put UEV agent on there, at V agent on there with two little commands. But you need to get some application sequenced and delivered to your operating system. So whether you're using the sequencer, whether you're using Office and O365, and you also need to think about your UEV generator. And you've seen in a demo, a few slides, what I mean by this experience.
It's interesting, Dave, because if you support at V in the enterprise, you have to be familiar with the majority of this slide deck here for many organizations. So to call somebody an at V engineer is kind of an insult to them in terms of their total skill set. I mean, most at V engineers are the ultimate in an IT pro because they have to understand and be familiar with and be able to troubleshoot just about everything that at V may be hooking into, which pretty much reflects a lot of this slide here. And we're not even talking about our third-party software.
And that's the thing as well, Steve's mentioned it here, this can expand to even more areas. So this is all I could put on the slide. I wish I could expand it to more, but I'd end up having really small text, which would be really difficult. So you've done your deployment, so you need to know at V, UEV, these little small agents with all this complex area. You then need to think about how you manage your packages. And this is quite important in certain scenarios. So you can break packages generally down into two categories. Your first category is global machine applications. They're your Office 2013, 2016, Adobe Reader, Firefox I've just put on here because quite a lot of people deploy Firefox to all users. But the most important piece here, which we're trying to say, is Office 2013 and Adobe Reader DC, if you follow their guidance, have to be published globally to the machine, which means it's available for all users. You are unsupported if you don't deploy Office globally to the machine. You then have the second category. Your second category is your user applications. I've just chosen some very generic ones here. Beyond Compare, Notepad++, WinSCP. You need to think of your strategy up front. Do I need global packages, which are machine for everybody, or do I need user packages for just targeting users? So for people using Chrome, are you targeting your users, or are you giving it to everybody on the machine? And they're your questions. So here's a real world story. I was, I can't remember where I was. I think I was in Holland. I flew over to Holland, and this customer had done some great work. They'd created their Windows 10 anniversary build. They'd created all their GPOs. They'd done everything. We deployed, so the Appy server was synced here. So you can see the bottom right corner syncing some applications. So it's a great step, our group policy set up correctly. I'm getting my Adobe Reader, my paint.net. I'm then going to get some few other applications. What a great experience for your user. Your apps have just come down like that using AppV. I launched Notepad, XML Notepad, and it works. Wow, what an easy experience this is deploying Windows 10. But Adobe Reader, failed to load its core DLL. Okay, boo. Paint.net, someone must have seen this. Paint.net has detected some important installation files are missing. Please repair it. So these are all AppV packages. So you had a great experience. You've deployed your build. You've had all your apps come down to the machine. But then you have these failures. So we have some common Windows 10 OS migration issues for you to be aware of. Please take these away. The general build failures are not enabling .NET 2 and 3. The most common failure we see. I helped a customer in London. They've got an application called Sims, which manages schools and manages the curriculum. I don't really know what it does. We deployed their app from their Windows 8 platform to Windows 10, instantly failed. Enabled this, instantly started working. It's amazing how people miss this one off when they do their base Windows 10 image. And the second ones are runtimes. How many people manage runtimes in the build as part of your MDT task sequence or config manager sequence? Please manage them in the build, get them on your box, and make sure when you're going to your 10 image that the same runtimes come across with you. If you want to enable .NET Framework, you can run it in your script using DISM. As long as you're pointing to your source location for where your ISO is, that will literally install it as part of your image. So put it in your task sequence and make sure it's there. And please follow our support article on our supported runtimes that we have available. So we have the two. This KB lists all our supported runtimes. Generally, we see a lot of customers putting all the runtimes in the build because it makes it a lot easier to manage the build. And you know, if you've got 20,000 images, you know 20,000 images have got the same .NET enabled and all the runtimes enabled on every machine. Or you use something like Config Manager to deploy those runtimes and you check that they've been installed. So we did all that work. You can tell where I'm going here. We had a broken machine. I enabled some .NET. I enabled some runtimes. And we then got this experience. Exactly the same thing, syncing. So Adobe Reader and Paint.net are going to come down to my box. Which they do. I'm then going to sync my user-based app, so XML Notepad is going to come down to my box. And we're going to do the same test. Launch XML Notepad. So if I launch XML Notepad, fantastic, it will work. Now, if I launch Paint.net, so I did it differently, now you find that it works. And that is missing the 2008 MFC runtime, which Paint.net requires, and Adobe Reader requires the 2010 32 and 64-bit runtime to let Adobe Reader work. So when you're troubleshooting your apps going to Windows 10, you may not be troubleshooting the right thing. You may just be missing something in your build. And that's the most important thing about this deck, which we want you to take away, is make sure your base components are installed, are available, so that you get this great experience when you move over to Windows 10 Anniversary. And that's where we want you to go. So the question now is, and we did said in the description, how do you upgrade from an older OS to Windows 10? And Mr. Thomas is actually going to talk you through upgrading to Windows 10 Anniversary.
So the most important thing to understand with the upgrade path from out-of-box AppV and UEV to in-box AppV and UEV is to first understand the SKU platform for which we will be supporting this. As Dave demonstrated earlier, if you attempt to install the out-of-box AppV or UEV client
5.1 or the 2.1 SP1 on Windows 10, anniversary edition or later, it's going to be blocked. It's also important to understand that only the enterprise and education SKUs are supported. If you are licensed for SA, you are licensed for enterprise. But this is going to be very important in planning your migration because Windows 10 Pro TH2, which are translated to as 1507 and 1511, actually did support the ATV5.1 client in the UEV 2.1 SP1 client. However, if you are running a build of Windows 10 Professional and you do an in-place upgrade to the anniversary edition, the ATV and UEV clients will be removed. So that is probably one of the most key things you should understand before embarking on an upgrade to Windows 10 anniversary with ATV and UEV in mind. Only the enterprise and the education SKUs are supported, and the ATV and UEV clients are removed if you upgrade from THX Pro to the Anniversary Pro. So, here we have VLC. Now, VLC is an ATV application running the ATV 5.1 client. And the 5.1 client is installed on this obvious Windows 7 box. And I just launched VLC just so we would know it was there. And now we're going to actually just do a quick inventory of our ATV packages running on 5.1, the out-of-box client on Windows 7. And we have Firefox, we have a couple of other applications as well. We have a mix of user-published and globally published applications. We have TextPad. And so now we're going to the DVD drive, and we're going to run a quick in-place upgrade setup using the ISO. Now, obviously, the last thing I would like to do is put you to sleep. So we're not going to do things like dynamic update and what things that we would normally encourage you to do, a compat scan to test for application compatibility. We're going to do the fastest possible ISO in-place upgrade we can, just to kind of walk you through the generic experience. It's also important, while this is preparing, to let you know that a compat scan cannot be reliable for determining compatibility status for existing ATV applications because of the way it actually inventories. So if you're using compat scan to determine application compatibility for the actual virtual applications, we would encourage you to rely on something like Upgrade Analytics, which has been released, or any of our partners who are actually helping with the actual assessment program here. Okay, so I want to keep my personal files and apps, obviously, and we're doing this on an actual release candidate, and so we're going to install through this and walk through and allow this to commence forth, and wow, Dave, this is moving amazingly fast.
I hope all your installs are this quick
for an in-place upgrade, isn't it? Imagine that, huh? Wow, that was really, really quick, wasn't it? Yes. How did he do that? And of course, go through this. We're not going to use Cortana right now. Yeah, lovely, new apps. It's going to finalize my settings. And there I am, going to log on. And we've gone back in time, as you can see, to July 28th. And we're going to do a quick login. And I'm logging in as the same user just to make sure that I have the applications that have been targeted not only to the machine, but the application that has been targeted to this specific user. And of course, they're going to tell me all about how they've updated my PC. I'm very happy you've updated my PC, but you know what I'm going to be really happy the most about, Dave? I'm going to be really happy that not only did these updates protect me in an online world, not only did it bring my applications over, not only did it give me back my start menu. Did I say that out loud? Never mind. But it let me keep my Windows 7 background on my Windows 10 box. All right, so now we're going to go and hunt down these virtual applications. But before we do that, we need to make sure, as we said earlier, that the AtV client and the UEV client are actually enabled. So I'm going to pull up PowerShell, run PowerShell as an administrator. I forgot to increase the font size. So we're going to enable AtV. AtV is enabled. Going to enable UEV. And of course, when you see this, as we mentioned earlier, it's going to tell us that we would have to actually reboot for those changes to take effect. And most importantly, we're going to launch the application to make sure they launch. And they are launched. At least VLC launched. So this is our goal of the upgrade to the inbox experience. Whereas in the past, if you had to rip and replace an actual AtV client, what would happen, Dave? Your applications would go, and you'd have to actually republish and restream down all of your applications. Fortunately, this new seamless upgrade allows us to actually move 100% perfectly, right? Well, we got a few caveats to talk about here, okay? So what you have to understand is we're moving from an out-of-box app into an inbox app. So our binaries are going to be relocated. Our binaries are going to be relocated to Windows System 32. Also, for those of you who have deployed UEV, UEV custom configuration will be retained. So you might potentially run into template path mismatches if you are pointing users to a custom local path, because if you physically set the default path as the custom path, that's going to actually be maintained. However, the default path for your templates are actually moved beneath the Windows System 32 directory. So be very careful of that when planning your upgrade. Now, the title of this presentation relates to design. And people ask me on a lot of engagements about sizing UEV in terms of capacity planning. It's pretty easy to understand the intricacies of individual applications. We know that Office is going to take up a couple of gigs. We know that WinZip is only going to take up a few megs. But the question is, how do we size and plan for UEV? Because UEV, we purposely designed it not to have a lot of moving parts. There is no back-end infrastructure. It's designed to work in the existing infrastructure that you have with GPOs, with your existing storage deployment scenarios, be it just file shares, be it OneDrive for Business, OneDrive work folders. But the storage component is probably the most important thing. So what kind of approach am I going to take to sizing and capacity planning for UEV? Well, a lot of people take what I call is the sledgehammer approach, where they will approach it by average PKGX size for the registry, which is 10 to 15K. All of our registry settings are stored in these PKGX files. They also will size it according to PKGDAT, average file size. Each individual file preference is stored as a PKGDAT file. And some will just simply estimate the average total user size. And this has been pretty good for us advising customers that you can expect for the average user, the average information worker, about 20 megs. Of course, we all work a lot with personas. We all work with different profiles for our individual users. Some of our users are users who use 5 to 10. Some of our users are developers. Some of our users are our own IT pro staff. So in some cases, we have to actually also incorporate the impact on the network when we're actually logging on. Because when you log on for the first time, there's, of course, a download. There's a sync. And the nice thing about UEV is UEV has defined sync triggers, which are publicly available, which allow us to determine when we're going to be dealing with potential network load for downloading these setting storage items. The sync method is probably the second most common question asked about UEV design. Which UEV sync method is actually going to work for what I want in terms of the end user experience? So, do you want instant settings synchronization? Or do you want relatively quick settings synchronization? Do you want full control and you want to eliminate as many variables as possible in the sync model? All of these questions must be asked and answered when determining your actual method. The default is the sync provider. In the case of the sync provider, it's designed to work with offline files to give you a local sync folder cache. And then, of course, we rely on the offline folders engine to actually upload and actually store those in your file share location. But for many scenarios, especially VDI scenarios, and in some cases, any environment where you want instantaneous data center speed synchronization, session host, for example, they turn it off. Sync method none, which means the setting storage path is where we go every single time. Now, of course, it's the fastest way to sync, but there's some trade-offs. That's where you're going to have most of your network traffic being generated. Or there is external. External is great because you can just pass it off to a local cache and rely on an external sync provider to actually do the synchronization across devices. OneDrive for business, work folders, Dropbox. What's important is it only synchronizes on triggers, not heartbeat. It assumes local connectivity always, and we call this as well eventual settings synchronization. Now, why do we use the term eventual settings synchronization? Because we can't guarantee synchronization across devices. Why? Because we're not doing it. Unlike with none, where we are doing it, we're relying on OneDrive, OneDrive for Business, work folders, or Dropbox to actually do that. And let's say you're in a VDI scenario, for example, especially non-persistent VDI. Which is going to work best for you? Probably none. Why would external not work great for a non-persistent VDI scenario? Well, user logs on for the first time. What is not available yet to that user? What is not completely provisioned 100% to that user? The cloud scenario. You know what it's like with OneDrive, logging on for the first time, OneDrive for business. You've got to actually go through the process. And even though you can automate that, you still have to do an initial authentication. Well, the user's already logged on, so they're not going to have their settings. They're going to have to log off and then log back on. And if the cloud sync provider has actually done the synchronization, then they will have their settings. That is why you probably want to use none as your provider for those scenarios. By the way, the link below at the very bottom talks a little bit more in detail about these sync settings. Still though, we have those who want more of a granular approach to template design. They want to understand the impact of storage, especially for those users that may have 30 applications, those users that may have 40, and especially if we're using the user's home directory, which is one of our recommendations for on-premises, to actually store this. They want to know the impact. They want to be able to guess the impact and at the same time go back to their IT bosses and tell them, look, here is where we are with roaming user profiles. Here is where we can be with UEV and folder redirection. This is how much storage we could potentially save. So, from my experience, these are generally the numbers that we see with specific types of applications. A lot of your applications are small, and they really only have registry preferences. They really only have registry settings. So you're going to see 2K to 15K generally run in terms of your size, because there's only going to be a PKGX file. Things like 7-Zip, Notepad are like that. Adobe Reader and Acrobat, which or Adobe Reader, Paint.net, et cetera, those are some of your typical applications. You might see a little bit of a greater range because you might see a few file preferences in there as well. Large applications and application suites like Office, Firefox, Ultra Edit, for example, may give you anywhere from 2 megs to 4 megs, especially if you're using the built-in Office templates, although We don't roam everything with our built-in or our Microsoft available Office templates, because obviously there are many things that you don't want roaming through UEV. And then of course Windows settings will range anywhere from 2 megs to 4 megs, where you have your desktop settings, themes, ease of access, your logging command prompt. And then of course, what we find with IE, IE, people tend to be moving away from that, looking at ESR, but we would see anywhere from 200 to 400K using the standard templates. And of course, some people would build their own IE templates so they could roam temporary internet files. Please don't do that. Please don't do that. And that's a good time to talk about good versus bad templates. Now, there's arguments to whether we should use evergreen templates or non-evergreen templates, but the problem you want to run into is, or that you're going to run into, is you're going to have a lot of excess stuff that you really didn't need. And if you have a lot of excess material in your templates, this could be very, very problematic. So, you should understand that everything should not roam. Not everything within the OS was designed to roam. You should be aware that many unsupported template items, especially in Office and especially in some of our built-in Windows templates, are unsupported for a reason. A question I get asked all the time is, why isn't MRU, you know, most recently used, or shortcuts actually roamed by default? And the problem with that is, what if you roam to a device where they're not there? The documents aren't accessible, or the applications aren't installed. Then you wind up having dead icons. Dead icons or error messages trying to locate a specific file, which could be locatable, just not in the exact location that was saved in the MRU. And that generates what? Support calls. Support calls are costly. We want to keep support calls down. Also, certain settings, especially within the built-in Office templates, require special custom actions on the part of UEV, like Outlook signatures. Outlook signatures uses a custom action to ensure that they actually roam. We advise you not to use your own templates, but to use our templates so we can use our streamlined mechanism, our streamlined custom action for roaming Outlook signatures. As the product is more and more invested in, we will continue to add more custom actions to, like we've done with credentials and certificates and network printer roaming as well. But you want to avoid something like this. Hundreds of megs in a setting storage path. Can you imagine the impact on an application launch when you're actually trying to launch that? That's what can happen with some of these evergreen templates. In fact, let's look at the impact on performance here. So we're launching Google. And this is a normal launch up of Google Chrome. We're going to close it out. Then we're going to bring up this one actually has a larger font. So we're going to register a UEV template for Chrome. And it's going to be registered now. And so we're going to now minimize this. We're going to go back to Google Chrome. And notice what's happening with Google Chrome. Okay, it was supposed to be slower, but that was still a significant difference, wasn't it? Yeah, okay. So it's very easy to just do a quick registration of the template and an unregistering to compare the launch times between having a UEV template registered and not having a UEV template registered. A significant difference. That's what can happen if you have a heavily large setting storage path. So, Why certain elements aren't supported? Shortcuts, no guarantee of path match or software availability. IE elements like cookies, the EMIE cache, etc., are also not supported because of fragility and potential impact on performance. And of course, your most recently used are also not supported with UEV. We know some people out there will try to do it anyway. Your mileage may vary. We just wanted to give you reasons why we want you to have a reliable experience, and we want the product to not create any more problems unnecessarily. So, thank you for being with us today. And the point of this, the last 65, 70 minutes, is to kind of give you an overview of how, and you know, as much time as we had, an overview of how AppV and UEV will actually fit into the model of an ongoing Evergreen Windows. The concept of lift and shift applications, decoupled user state, frequent incremental minor updates. So your application management and your application lifecycle and compatibility factories can be easily incorporated into this new risk-based iterative project management style. Now, if you have questions, and I'm sure many of you do, we would like to get a lot of these recorded as well, so we would ask that you step up to one of the microphones to actually ask the question. In the meantime, if you are headed out, we of course invite you to, oops, oh, you got it, okay. Please evaluate this session. Please give out feedback. If you want to continue to see more AppV and UEV stuff at Future Ignites, please feel free to give that feedback as well. And let's move on to some of the questions. We have one question right here.
Hi, my name is Graham from Global Knowledge. I was wondering, the credential roaming policy, is that still, what's the recommended practice associated with that? The group policy that allows me to source certificates and passwords in Active Directory?
So we would recommend you to use one or the other if you're talking about comparing that with UEV, correct?
Yeah, well, that's the certificates and stuff don't get included in UEV, do they?
We roam certificates now, yes. 2.1 SP1 and later, yes.
Okay, so we should...
Oh, you're talking about certs.
Yeah. I see.
Continue to vote that up at user voice.
Pardon me?
Continue to vote that up at user voice, the feature.
Okay, so at this point, we should still be recommending the
AD,
use of that.
Yes.
Because we're turning off the roaming profiles.
Yep, that's a big one with roaming profiles, is people needing to get the actual the certificate store roamed.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Hi, I'm wondering what your guidance is on VDI infrastructures that are globally distributed. How do you manage the end user state across different VDI infrastructures? Pooled VM specifically.
So this would be roaming state across global clusters, for example?
Yes.
Well, so for some of our customers, when they're doing that, they rely on an external synchronization mechanism like DFSR, for example, if they're actually wanting to make that stuff available across global clusters. For example, if they have a user traveling from Europe to the Americas, probably the most logical mechanism, if this user is using, for example, a sync provider of none or a sync provider of using the online provider or offline files, the idea is there's going to be an available backend share in the background. And so in order, like with the AppV package store, the settings store, they would roam they would synchronize using DFSR or some type of storage synchronization engine. The problem you want to avoid is if you have your sync provider setting to none, for example, or using the offline provider and the setting storage path is overseas, there's obviously going to be some potential latency
Right. Dealing
with that. Now, that can be tweaked with timeouts in the UEV custom configuration, but you don't want to raise that timeout value extremely large, because what would happen if that template's not available, it's going to keep trying and trying and trying and trying, and that's going to delay the launch of the application and even potentially delay log on.
So. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Hi, I have a small question about Outlook. For years, we sync the Outlook profile, and officially, it's not supported in UIV.
Nope.
So we don't really understand what's the solution for that, because when a user always have to log on, it always takes time, the auto-discovery process has to roll out. So we really don't understand why it's not included.
So
what are the dangers to do it? What's the reason?
I get this a lot. I get a lot of questions about Outlook. And it's usually they want everything in Outlook to synchronize. And what we need to do as a community is prioritize what is it the most important elements within Outlook that you want synchronized. I mean, we have people wanting UEV to even try to synchronize PST files, for example, which definitely can be problematic. But individual components like auto discovery, for example, that's something that you would have to recommend that specific scenario to the product team through user voice. And then the product team would have to make sure that if this was something feasible or if this was something that could be included in the product, that it's not going to step over any other potential policy that you might have with either Exchange Online, Office 365. Because what if you run into a scenario where you are caching information that's now changed on the back end? There could be conflicts there. There could be potential regressions there. So what the team has to do a lot of times, and I can throw Tommy under the bus as well if you want to talk to him as well. We actually have our UEVPM and AppVPM here, but they have to address these individual scenarios. And sometimes, as I mentioned earlier, it takes a special custom action in the actual product to ensure that these elements actually get roamed outside of the standard template model.
Okay, because we roam it now, but we don't experience any problems. So I'm curious what the problems are then.
Okay.
Okay.
So I have a question regarding, user profile management with AppV and ZenApp or remote desktop services. We have a need to roam the copy on write directory out of local app data from AppV. We currently use third party profile management software. Mm-hmm. Does UEV support roaming the copy on write directory for the AppV client?
We would do it automatically, Steve.
What's that?
We'd capture the state anyway inside the package. So what, are you roaming the actual cow, the whole cow directory?
Right. Well, I wouldn't necessarily need to roam the whole thing, but we have some older applications that write INI files to program files, for instance.
Are you talking app data local or app data roaming?
App data local.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Okay.
Okay.
So, one of the design factors of UEV is to be package format agnostic.
Right.
So you could do things even like roam universal settings within a regular native application to an AppV application back and forth.
Right.
And for that reason, the UEV filter driver actually sits above the AppV filter drivers.
Okay.
And the reason for that is if you have virtualized Adobe Reader and a local Adobe Reader, UEV is going to roam the settings, and then AppV will take care of putting it in the cow.
Gotcha.
So the concept is let's keep our hands off the local state data, and let's rely on the actual UEM provider to do that. Of course, whether or not a UEM provider is able to do that depends on the relationship of what kind of architecture that UEV or that UEM provider uses.
Okay.
I ran into problems with customers where they were double roaming, and it was causing further delays because they were roaming the application data and the subsequent CAL data, and it was completely redundant because they only needed to be roaming the actual application data. But if that filter driver that's used by that UEM is not sitting in the right place, it may not be able to capture that application data.
Right. Well, we don't actually, our profile management solution doesn't use the filter driver. So, yeah, it just copies directly in, and it's
obviously
breaking our CAL directory. So, UEM.
That sounds like a case for UEV.
That's what I'm thinking. But
yes.
I was just wondering, that would be fully supported. Yes, I mean, we wouldn't necessarily need to roam the cow at that point.
And we have an AppV publish template that contains all of the supported AppV state data that does roam with UEV. And a lot of people will look at the contents of that app state XML so they can then take those settings and incorporate them into their UEV or their UEM solution.
Right. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Dylan, I just had a question about the upgrade that you showed going from an existing Windows 10 to the anniversary edition.
Actually, that was Windows 7.
That was Windows 7. Yeah. But is it the same concept with if I have the older Windows 10 and I upgrade to the anniversary edition, will it?
If it's enterprise or education.
If it's enterprise or education, it leaves it behind or it uninstalls it?
It leaves it behind.
It does.
It brings everything over. It's okay. When you upgrade to Pro Anniversary Edition.
Okay, so Enterprise, it leaves it alone.
Enterprise is the way to go, yes. Or Education.
So we're way over time, Steve.
Thank you very much.
So thank you, everybody, for attending. I appreciate your time.